Hello and welcome to Wise Women, the Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experiences of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything. We're sitting in Susie's cottage on Dartmoor in Devon. This is the most beautiful rural landscape. I call Dartmoor the bones of the land. And I'm a vicar. I'm sitting here in my dog collar with a mug of echinacea tea. And Susie has not burnt me at the stake. Thank you.
I think the burning at the stake went the other way round, actually, Maggie.
Which may be something we have to discuss at some point.
Indeed.
But we're here really to talk about the Great Mother, the Great Father, the land, the sacred, the richness in our two traditions that actually meets at a focal point in the middle, which is where we start, I hope.
Yes, I'd love to explore the many questions that I have of you. I know that you know a huge amount about not just Christianity, but the history of all the ways, all the human ways of knowing the sacred that have become Christianity. And I know that you know a huge amount, perhaps more than, well, definitely more than anyone else I know, about what is your religion really? Where did it come from? Why is it? And how is it meant to be? And I've learned, even just in our conversations this morning, that there is the world of difference between what's actually dogma, what's actually the teachings within your church, and what most people think are the teachings within your church. And I see you sitting there as a woman who I totally regard as my sister, with your very different description of the sacred. And I see that my way of viewing the sacred and expressing it has come under exactly the same set of kind of, you know, misapprehensions, if you like, and that what people think they know about the ways that you and I express the sacred are sometimes based in ignorance and judgment and not at all in what really is going on. And so really, for quite selfish ends, I'm fascinated. I'm so up for having these conversations with you whereby we really find out what is it that you do believe, and what are the things that you perceive yourself to have been taught as dogma, if you like, or as truth with a capital T? And yeah, who is God or the goddess, and where are they, and all those amazingly wonderful and important questions that I think it's important that we all ask.
And I want to talk to you very much about your love of the land, the sacred mother, your lifestyle, how you get up every morning and sing creation into being. I actually experienced that once at a monastery, a Franciscan nuns monastery, where they sang louds at dawn. And I thought, this is just like the ancient Egyptians singing in the dawn. Not that the dawn needs it, but why wouldn't we celebrate it? And what I love and honour about you is you live with this land, you honour the land, you adore the land, you worship the land, and you have a mission right now. Christianity has been patriarchal for far too long. Witchhood is generally seen as matriarchal, and it is time for the divine feminine. We need the yin. This land is suffering because of yang, 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 yang. And I'm mixing metaphors again. Now we're going oriental. But what I love about you is you're so balanced, and you will always err to the side of the yin, whereas I will err to the side of the yang. And if we can pull that together in these conversations and have a lot of love and laughter in the meantime and a few more cups of tea, I'll be a very happy bunny. Oh, he's coming up to Easter time, so that's appropriate. Your turn.
Okay, so because this is our first conversation, I think it would be a really good idea to I want to ask you, and then I'd like you to ask me, why are you a vicar? What is it about the particular flavour of Christianity and kind of it meeting Judaism, which is what I see in your particular flavour, but I may be looking through misty glasses. Why a vicar?
Well, it's a long story, but I became a vicar because a priest told me that my dying husband was going to hell. I was 33 at the time. I'd been married for 1 year and Henry had cancer, and a hospital chaplain who turned out to be an angel. I'm not knocking this guy anymore, though he had a very bad wig. It really was a very bad wig. And he told me that Henry would not go to heaven because he didn't worship our Lord Jesus Christ, as he said. And at that point, I was what you'd call an armchair Christian. Turned up at Christmas, turned up at Easter, maybe, after the lines of St. Augustine, which is, God grant me chastity, constancy, and patience, but not yet. You know, and basically what happened was I thought, that can't be right. So at Henry's funeral, I said to the vicar, because back in those days, 30 years ago, there wasn't the choice of funerals you can have now. It was basically humanist or Christian. And my family weren't going to go for humanist. So I said to the vicar, please don't say those words, I am the resurrection and the life, as we go up the aisle, because I'll hear Henry damned to hell. And he said, I'm sorry, my dear, those are the words of the Christian service. So I did walk up the aisle of the church behind my husband's coffin, hearing him damned to hell. And I threw my conventional Christianity absolutely out of the window at that point. Threw it out, stamped on it, wasn't going to have anything to do with it. Dived into holistic medicine, ran a holistic magazine. But after about 5 years of that, I was doing really well. I trained as a healer. Everything was coming round nicely. But I realised that in the corner of my room, figuratively, there was a beautiful pink silk cloth covered in tea lights and crystals that was covering a separating mass of hatred of Christianity. And I knew that had to go. So I enrolled at Birmingham University to study New Testament Greek, then found out there are 32,000 versions of the New Testament in Greek, so it wasn't going to get very far there. But it was very useful starting to get into the language. And then the Holy One introduced me to a Jewish man who was at the end of his rope from his religion, as I was at the end of the rope from mine. He spoke Hebrew. So between the two of us, we reeled each other in by exploring, what is this actually about? Underneath the dogma, underneath, and I will say, the crap. What was the origin of this? Why did it happen? What was necessary about it? What was it for? And I found such blessings in Jewish mysticism. And this man really turned my life around by introducing me to that. And of course, when it was right, we parted. Because we'd done exactly what we needed for each other. And that took me on another journey around divorce and Christianity, which hopefully we'll get to another day. But I could talk for hours and hours and hours. But my journey has been always about, I want to get inside the box, because you can do more from inside the box. And when I was offered ordination, I took it because it was a particular church, not a conventional Christian church, but an acknowledged one, the old Catholic, the independent Catholic Church. And I was approached. You don't apply. You get approached by somebody who'd seen me do a funeral for a murder victim. And I was against it to start with. But once this amazing bishop taught me what could be done from inside, and how we can help people who have suffered so much from Orthodox fundamentalist religion. And that's where I am today. That's my job. My job is the healing of Christianity, to go back to the roots of this guy who wandered around Galilee and Jerusalem, healing everyone. No questions asked. And who pointed out that those from outside his own tribe, the Roman centurion, the Samaritan woman, the woman taken in adultery, the lepers, all the people who were judged as being lesser or rubbish, he never went up to anybody and said, are you gay? Because if you are, I can't heal you. He healed everyone. And he brought hope to the poor, the oppressed, the slaves, the women. And that's what I return to every time. So how did you become a witch?
It seems likely that I came in with, in some way, the word witch tattooed on some part of my being that I can't see and everyone else can. I acquired, if you like, the nickname witch at every school I ever attended from the very first one. So literally aged five, I was being called witch by my peers. There was some kind of happening that took place in there was an area of trees outside my primary school where people, it was the 70s, and nobody would be allowed to climb a tree now outside of school, I'm sure. But anyway, this lad was climbing a tree and I think he was dropping things on me, or perhaps just unkind words on me. Anyway, evidently I witched him, and that's why he fell out of the tree. His being five and his ineptitude clearly had nothing to do with it. And just from then onwards, everywhere I went, I got called witch. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that, but I think the main one is that because of the fortunate family background I have, my grandparents on my mother's side are Irish, and they were very, very proud of Irish heritage, of the ancient pagan past of Ireland, and of the sort of fairy past of Ireland. And both my grandfather's mother and my grandmother's aunt were very psychic women, and they had reputations locally for, you know, truth telling of the future and saving people's lives, even through the things that they had offered up as kind of wisdom. And so when I, as a child, was seeing fairies and seeing tree spirits and listening to the wind and having a conversation with a rabbit or whatever, nobody in my family was telling me to belt up. They were all going, you know, in my grandmother's words, "How fascinating, darling." And so it wasn't squished out of me in the way that it's squished out of other children. And only briefly in my early 20s did I have that sort of experience of, okay, I've really had it with being called a witch. I'm going to shut all this down. And by that time, it was pretty much too late. I really couldn't shut it down. And I found fairly swiftly that I didn't really want to shut it down, because if you don't know when the scary thing is about to happen, it's way more scary than when your, you know, follicles are already prickling, kind of thing. So that's, I guess, how it is that I am how I am, and how it is that I now claim the word witch, is because I see that we've lost all our words that mean the one who knows, or the one who speaks with herbs, or the one who listens to the wind, or the one who sings the dawn into being with her praise, or whatever it is. We don't really have any words that all of us understand. We used to have lots of words. So the more obvious among them being cunning woman. Mm-hmm. So cunning, kenning, one who knows. But even that, you know, the majority of people would be, "What? You know what, love?" So witch covers it.
But there's a point of contact immediately, because the Jewish mystical tradition at the time of the First Temple and the beginning of the Second Temple, the people who were the prophets, the people who did know, were called those who knew. Mm. Those who know. And the Jewish mystical tradition that I'd love to study, and it's nothing to do with the Kabbalah Center, but it's called Kabbalah because it's the Hebrew word for receive, the received wisdom. And if you do a mass and you do it consciously, you receive. It's an utter, utter blessing to do a mass consciously, because this service has been done in one way or another for 4,000 years. A similar service was done before Jesus. And when you do this little ritual, it's known and presences come. I had to do a requiem yesterday, and I'm lost for words at the beauty of it sometimes. And I'm not sure that very many vicars do that. But hey, I'm a vicar, so I'm very blessed that I can do it. But I can completely identify with the idea of having it squashed out of you. When I was a little girl, because I'm Maggie, I was Mag the Hag at school, so I suppose I had a destiny too. So it was always hag this or hag that. But when I was very young, my mother read me a book by Elizabeth Googe called The Little White Horse.
Oh, I used to love that book.
Yes, I remember sitting at her feet in front of the fire and having her read it out loud before I went to bed. And that book just sparked something in me. Lord, I'm sounding like a witch. This won't do at all. Anyway, I was in church at the age of 9, and we were singing the Magnificat, which is what Mary allegedly sang to Elizabeth. Mary was pregnant with Jesus, and Elizabeth was pregnant with John the Baptist, and Mary went to see Elizabeth, and the babies recognized each other and leapt in the womb. And Mary sings this beautiful song, "My soul will magnify the Lord." Mm-hmm. And as I sang that in church, something happened. The whole spectrum of everything changed. So there was colour I could hear and taste and touch. And something angelic said to me, you will do this. And I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know anything. But fortunately, having had my head stuck down the lavatory for saying I saw a fairy once, I never told anybody until I was 30. Because it was just something that I knew that one day would reveal itself to me as to what I would be doing. And possibly this is it. Because what I would be doing would be magnifying the Lord, you know. But whatever we would call the Lord, that in the New Testament Greek would be Theos, but actually it was in the Hebrew, beg your pardon, it would have been Yahweh. And just to start off with something, did you know that Yahweh is the first thing every human being says when they're born and the last thing they say when they die? Because it's breath.
I did not know that.
And the whole concept behind that is that we are the breath of God. All of creation is the Christed one. And I'm getting way ahead of myself now, but you can see how incredibly enthusiastic I am about the roots of this faith, which has been covered up for so many years. And everything gets corrupted in the end by power, everything. But it's time now to get back to those roots and start revealing them again.
Yeah, beautiful. I'm still with you being in church and finding something beautiful. I'm afraid what I found in church at perhaps about the same age was that for me, the really, really full and certain knowledge that this was not for me. Mm-hmm. And that when concepts like original sin or damnation to hell were offered to me as reality, as really quite a small child, I think I might have been younger than 9, I just emphatically spat in the face of that reality and said, I am sorry, but this is not the world I live in. And this is not my experience of life with a capital L. And this is not my experience of the thing that I know that you guys are calling spirit. So the ones who do not have bodies, the ones who do not have material reality. And these ones that I know, they're not telling me I'm corrupt and sinful. They're not telling me they're going to send me to anywhere remotely resembling this hell place. They're telling me the world is full of love and unity and laughter and joyfulness. And I believe them because they are my authentic experience. And I do not believe you, because I do not see authenticity in what you're saying, and I do not believe it to be your experience. And that thing of being, and I don't mean the word preached as in this sentence as in any way denigrating those who preach at all, but being preached at by somebody who's following a script rather than being taught, really, which is what preaching is surely supposed to be, by somebody who's speaking from their heart or from their knowing, from their womb, from their true and authentic experience. I'm all ears. And I think that's why I find you so interesting, is you don't just know because you read it in a book. You know because your connection to your seeing and knowing and feeling in this reality, in all realities, tells you that's a really good explanation of the truth. And you also aren't saying to me, it's the only explanation of the truth.
No, many roads lead to Rome. And Rome's the problem with Christianity, actually. We need to get in one day. We've got to talk about this whole idea of hell and damnation. Because if you go right into the scriptures, right into the teachings, the early church fathers said there isn't enough hours in the day to talk to you about the hidden mysteries within the book. And it's all about the spaces between the words. If you put the law on the words, you're in trouble. What happened to Christianity was it was a wonderful faith for the oppressed about direct contact with the divine. When Jesus died on the cross, the veil of the temple was torn, the veil of the Holy of Holies, the thing that blocked humanity from the place where God was said to reside, was torn. And the idea was that this God-man came to earth to show us that God understood about pain and sacrifice, not to do anything about original sin, because it's not known in Judaism. It's a concept completely unknown in Judaism. We're going to talk more about this another time because it's a long story. But basically, we're meant to be shown by this life of this God-man, and there have been other God-men, I fully acknowledge that there have been, who came to just say that God is not remote. God is down and dirty with us, and God will help if we can align. It's all about alignment. But what happened to Christianity was the Emperor Constantine took it on in the early 4th century and made it the official religion of Rome. So basically he replaced Jupiter with Jesus and made God a warrior and a fighter and a killer and somebody who's on our side. And that was the losing point, when it was our God is against your God. And that was the danger of coming into a monotheistic culture, because everybody was going to say, my monotheistic culture is the right monotheistic culture and your monotheistic culture is the wrong one. And it always fascinates me when I look into Islam, the fact that the idea was that Muhammad was given the Quran because Christianity had failed. Now, I would venture to say that Islam in certain parts of its body is not doing terribly well either. But in the Sufi aspects or the mystical aspects, all the faiths will come back to the very heart and agree. So we have so much to talk about, because I need to talk to you about the work that you did with me. Susie was one of the people who helped save my life when I had what was deemed to be an incurable cancer. And I was sent to Susie and spent many an hour here, and many other wonderful people helped me as well. And they helped me surrender who I had been, all the opposition. So your work saved my life. So how could I not be your friend if you would allow me to be?
That's lovely. Thank you. I want to go back to what you just said about the war, the way that this kind of I'm right and you're wrong warlike attitude came basically with the Romans and from Rome, because that's been, where did this come from? Where did our propensity as a creature, as an animal, another aspect of Gaia, of life, how is it that we came to be so possessive of the idea of being right, and of why is it that we feel we need to control another person's version of reality, basically, which is what organized religions kind of seem to be doing, is constantly standing up going, I'm right, and by definition, if I'm right, you are therefore wrong, rather than these are the range of experiences and metaphors that we have for explaining reality, and they're all just different. And that kind of, you know, all roads lead to Rome and Rome's to blame for everything. You know, I was raised on Monty Python. It's, what is it? He's not the Messiah. He's just a very naughty boy. Just, I find it extraordinary and fascinating, the idea that a religion or a way of seeing the world can be, have been so hijacked by a way of being in the world which is in such direct contravention with all that I believe is right. And so, you know, to me, everything is God, if you like, or everything is the goddess. And there's, again, this is going to have to be another conversation because it's too much to put into one sentence. But for me, one of the kind of fundamental truths is that everything is born of woman. So everything is born of the divine. But we all also know that even were we to go so far as to say everything is born of the divine feminine parthenogenically, so you know, self-fertilized leave, virgin birth, a la Mary, that what we're also clearly talking about is the feminine igniting the masculine spark within herself. It's not possible to do the creation of life without both aspects. And that for me, when I use the word goddess, implicit in the word goddess is the notion that the goddess, in all the old stories, the really old stories, the goddess created the god and then she married him, and that's and yes. created the rest of existence. And that's not like, ew, a mummy had a baby and then she, you know, did all that thing that we really wouldn't approve of if these were beings in human bodies. But they're not, they're gods, and it's a metaphor. And oh my goodness, it's so easy to just ramble on and on and get very distracted to go off in all sorts of different directions.
And I'm trying so hard not to jump in. But if you think about it, in the Jewish tradition, if you look into the Hebrew, the first two words of the Bible that we have, because there were many versions of the Hebrew text of the Hebrew Testament before the diaspora, after the end of the temple, when the Romans took down the temple. Oh, we're going to be blaming Romans right, left and centre for this one. It all ended up being tribal, is the simple answer to what you were saying earlier. But at the beginning, the first two words are Bereshit Elohim. And Elohim is one of the names of God, 10 names of God in the Hebrew Testament. Elohim is a feminine noun with a masculine plural ending. So either it's a metaphor for the meeting of the sperm and the egg and the spark, which of course means a whole new meaning to the phrase Big Bang, or is the goddess doing exactly what you say, which is self-generating the male. And in the first temple, Dr. Margaret Barker is the lady to look out for. Find her on the internet. She's written the most wonderful books about the first temple. They honoured the divine feminine and the divine masculine, and they taught that the woman was both mother and wife of the king. A woman was both mother and wife of God. And this was destroyed 500 years before Jesus was born. And we will talk about more about the first temple, because it's utterly, utterly fascinating what went on there. But the idea is that woman gives birth to the king, who marries woman, who gives birth to the king. So the woman becomes queen and queen mother, and actually is Trinity. And this is the first mention we have of Trinity. And if you look at the Hebrew stories and the stories of the women particularly, they're incredible. We don't realise, people put the focus on the matriarchs, who were the youngest ones in the tribal consciousness, who got it all wrong. And then we move to Ruth and Esther and Hannah and the others, and they're telling the whole story of alignment and surrender to the divine. But they don't get half as much attention. And it's magical in there, but you've got to be able to read the spaces between the words, because if you only read the words, you're going to get a situation like I had in church. I was preaching a few weeks ago, and we had a very small congregation because the weather was very bad, and one man was very certain of his views. And I actually said, instead of a sermon, let's have a discussion, because I know you have questions, because although I am an ordained minister and entitled to teach you, I know that I have some ideas that you think are a little bit weird, so let's talk. And this man said, I know what's true, it's written in the Bible. And I said, which version? Because there are dozens. And he said, of King James. And I said, worst translation, beautiful poetry, really bad theology. And he said, but it's written down. It's what's written down. And I said, do you actually think that God stopped speaking 2,000 years ago? And there was this silence while everybody else went, oh. I said, God speaks all the time. God speaks to me. God tells me what to write in my blog. I greet God when I wake in the morning. The first thing I do every day when I wake up is say 100 things I appreciate to God. I don't thank God for them. I appreciate them. I'm not into that old, I've got to be terribly grateful to you, God, otherwise you're going to damn me to hell, which doesn't exist, but we'll get back to that. we could go on for ages and ages, but there's so much to talk about, and it's been a bit focused on me this time, so let's make quite sure that we talk a lot about your work next time. But I think we've probably done half an hour.
Oh, have we? Okay, mustn't ramble on too long. People will be bored.
I don't think so. You're a witch, you are. And we'll see you again for episode 2. Thank you for joining us on Wise Women,
the Vicar and the Witch.